We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, minds that are to our minds as ours are to the beasts in the jungle.
Don't adjust your sets. You are welcome to the Irish side of the moon. Good evening. Welcome to another great show of Irish Side of the Moon. My name is Gabriel Logue. And coming up, I'm talking to Mr. Michael Tesarian. Michael is, amongst other things, author, researcher, philosopher, alternative historian. Anything else you want to throw in, Michael?
No, that's more than enough, I think.
Okay. We're talking this show about one of Michael's later projects, The Architects of Control, a DVD that Michael and I think it was Red Ice Productions or Blue Fire, is it? Productions?
Yeah.
Worked with.
Our company is Blue Fire Films. Red Ice Creations is the radio station that Henrik and Frederick have, Gabriel. But Blue Fire Films is our, it's a production company.
That's it. Okay.
We produce the films through that.
Okay. I've watched The Architects of Control now numerous times. Before we go into it, I just want to throw this out. We're broadcasting from latitude 54.94 and longitude 7.71. Anyone out there listening, figure it out, drop me an email at gabriel@theirishsideofthemoon.ie. Just a little interesting thing. Michael, great to have you on the show. You were born in Belfast, I believe, yes?
That's right. I grew up there, yeah.
It's an obvious thing to say with that accent, right?
Oh, yeah.
How long have you been living in the States, Michael?
I've been coming and going for at least 18 years. So I'm always back in Europe as much as I can and in Britain. And in fact, the last couple of years while I was writing the Irish Origins book, I was glad to say I was able to get back more, right, to Britain and to Ireland, which was great, because, of course, Belfast has changed an awful lot and not in good ways, in my opinion. But, again, there are certain positive aspects. But my business side of it, the interest side of it, is definitely more in America than it is in Europe or Britain, for sure.
I have a question. Why haven't they kicked you out of the States?
Oh, I've never had any problems like that, and they're free to do it. You know what I'm saying? My philosophy is that if they don't like what I do, they have the perfect right to make a move on me. I don't hold anything like that against them. This is the system. This is the establishment. But I pay my taxes, and I very much abide by the law. I support the law and the police and stuff like that because I'm rebellious in attitude.
Yes.
But I'm not just, it's exactly the same reason that when I left Ireland, I didn't want to go up there and sit on Geary Street in a bunch of Irish pubs and have fist fights about the old country.
Yeah.
not that I don't have strong beliefs about things, but, that's not the, it's like do as the Romans do. I didn't travel 6,000 miles to do what I'd be doing downtown in Belfast.
Unfortunately,
many Irish people, that's exactly what they do, they may move physically, but they haven't moved mentally, and the moment that they hear an English accent, they want to punch up or whatever else it might be. And, that still goes on, by the way, in Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco, and I won't be any part of it. Doesn't mean that I'm any less Irish. Doesn't mean that I still don't have my belief systems. But I'm just not going to go and, have a fight with a bunch of American policemen or anything like that, over some minor point. So, as a scholar, as a teacher, I realize that I've got this professional persona, and then there's me. I play guitar, I listen to heavy metal, I smoke cigarettes. I'm just the ordinary fella that I was, back then in the good old days when I grew up in Ireland, But then you have your public persona. And, of course, it's very important at that point to, not look like a roughneck and a maniac. you know, when you're coming across to people, because they won't value what you're saying then, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I hear that. I hear that, all right. Heavy metal, huh? The devil's music, Michael.
Oh, yeah.
Right, Architects of Control. For anyone out there who hasn't come across this, and indeed anyone who has watched it, can you give sort of an overview of what is the Architects of Control all about?
I'll be happy to, Gabriel. And again, thanks for the time. You know,
not at all.
It's good to speak to somebody from Ireland as well, because that's basically where, you know, my whole process started. Basically, it summed up the fact is that there's two things that really that Henrik and Frederick and I were thinking about when we did this one, and that is that there's a lot of people in this movement who tend to imagine that just because they've watched a few YouTubes or, you know, whatever, or Googles or, you know, short clips or browsed through a few books, that they kind of know what it's all about, you know. And of course, that's not true. And it's certainly not true to somebody who has every year from the time they've been a young man, you know, studied this thing very deeply and under great difficulty, you know, both financial and other resistances. Obviously, there's a difference there between people who are then suddenly thinking they know it all. You know, they have this know-it-all attitude because it's, you know, the MySpace generation and it's the Google generation, and there's more of this information out there, which is a very good thing, by the way.
Yeah.
But there tends to be this then feeling that just because people have, you know, caught these sound bites and they've heard the term Illuminati, or they've been shaken up by 9/11, there's a big difference between the shaken up person and the woken up person. And again, a lot of these people are going to end up down another cul-de-sac. They're going to get jaded. They're going to get tired. They're going to get paranoid, or they're going to just literally fade away from this information. This is what happens. And we thought about that, and we said, well, we're sick talking to the choir. We do not want to talk to this choir anymore, because, you know, they think they know it all, and it's a, and the people who've been following our work for a long time, they're up to speed on what we're doing, and that's fine. And then on the other side, you've got people who are desperate for this information. They're into it for the first time, because of these, you know, things that are coming down on us now in society. They are actually waking up. And therefore, if we are too far along in our process, they're going to, you know, we're going to lose these people, because we've lost that mind of the beginner. We've lost that passion. So, and I never have myself. So we really sat down and said, look, let's sort of slow down and take a lot of the information that we have. And in this particular program one, let's meet them halfway, and let's bring up some stuff that maybe some seasoned people know a lot about or think they know a lot about. But let's be very conscious of the newcomer. So this is what that was all about. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that we were there, you know, to chop up things too small or talk down to anyone at all. It just was the fact that by email now, and the people we meet in the street, you know, there's so many new people. There's a lot more new people coming in this particular era than there ever has been in the whole history of this movement. And so if you go too fast and you get too esoteric, and I did a lot of that in the Irish Origins book, you know, that was a phase in the last, since 06 to 07, where I had to go into some very deep and, you know, labyrinthine ways. And so the Architects of Control thing was a little bit of a, you know, a little break from that, and to go back into some of the information we've dealt with and had lots of notes about, but to treat it in a little bit different way, so that the average person, you know, the teens and the younger people and the people for the first time, could really understand it and not feel that it's like too, you know, much something that they have to bite down on too hard, or take, you know, it's too much of a mouthful or whatever.
Okay.
That was one of the ideas.
Right.
The other idea was, of course, to deal with the theme that I've been dealing with for many years, and that is that if there is these, you know, problems in the world, and if we see the state of decay that we do, you know, my approach to it is that it's you and I, it's the human race, bringing it about. It's not so much about evil arcs on the hill, which has been the traditional way of looking at this, the blame game, the pointing of the fingers. My work is very psychologically based, and all of my work goes into the origins of consciousness, the origins of the ego, the origins of injustice and evil and things like that. And I never leave consciousness at the door. So one of the biggest themes that we wanted to make sure is the theme of the entire series, and we'll be doing a great deal more of this in the next program in the series was this aspect of looking at psychology, looking at the psyche, asking a few questions about what it is that we do to bring these kinds of tyrannies into existence. I dealt with this in 2006 in August when I did the talk down in, or I think it was actually June, down in Los Angeles. And that has over 1 million people watched that on, you know, Google and YouTube. Over 1 million people. It was already 300,000 people just in the first 3 months. And by the time the year was over, it was up to like 800,000 people. Gabriel watched that little thing that wasn't even planned. And then that was 2006. So by now, you know, we know it's probably up towards 2 million people have watched that little video and loved it. And I've got incredible feedback from it. This is how I realized something was up. Right. Because I thought that was just another little talk I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
The feedback was so incredible, going, tell us more, tell us more. You're onto something there. We like it. And that was also one of the big reasons why we want to sit down and do Architects of Control, to follow on from that Los Angeles talk, which was about, you know, the future of mankind, and emphasizing this idea that if man's inner house isn't in order, and if he doesn't deal with his own, you know, penchant for self-sadism and all of these things, mm-hmm. you know, he is not going to be hygienic enough to create a perfect society. He's not going to be hygienic enough to fight the establishment in a true way, and he's not going to be clean enough and hygienic enough to receive what the universal intelligence, his own inner guides or the God force, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. is transmitting to him. So he's way behind. You know, he's got a lot of catching up to do, and it's because too many of the authors and writers in this field have left consciousness at the door, and the people who deal with consciousness, they aren't interested in conspiracy. They won't touch it.
Okay.
So these two worlds haven't really come together.
Michael, a very salient, poignant point. I'm going to make a mental note of what you said. I'll come back to it because it's one of those things that I want or hope that you'll explore in some detail. But let's just go ahead with your overall overview of the architects. We'll come back to it. It is a huge piece for me, is this consciousness expansion. And you touched upon it in Architects of Control. But I felt that, wow, there was a chance that you could have really went into that. Now, maybe you've done it in program two. I don't know, or intend to do it. But anyway, leave it for now. We'll come back to it. Let me just...
Oh, well, we will be really dealing with it. We are dealing with it in the new one. As I said, it's not that the first one is a primer or anything, but it kind of was. It was kind of like, let's introduce it. Mm. Let's work up to it slowly. Let's deal with general ideas of mind control. And the psychotropics, you see, because remember, there's a lot of people who are not even aware even of the basics. They're not even aware that the media does what it does. Again, we're in the early stages of all of this, you know?
What are the basics?
Well, the basics are that there is a thing called the mind, and that the war that this establishment figures, be they called Luciferians or Atonists or whatever you want to call them, they are aware of the dynamics of the psyche. It's not just the Sigmund Freuds and the Jungs and the good people who are trying to help mankind. The establishment is armed up to the teeth with knowledge about man's biology, his psyche, his drives, his complexes, his syndromes, his sexual hang-ups, his biology, you see, all of the above. They have an entire medical leviathan that is meant to be taking care of your physical illnesses. And let's take that point. How many actors do you know who, with all the money they have and all the fame and all the travel that they've done, as soon as they get cancer, they walk right into where? The hospitals. I'm thinking of John Thaw, and I'm thinking of a lot of other guys, only to die. Presidents have been killed. You know, famous people have been killed at early ages. I've got lists and lists of these people who have gone in, and you think that these people, you know, I don't care if it's Kylie Minogue or John Thaw or whoever, you know, jumps to mind, Elvis or whoever. These are worldly wise people. They have as much access, if not more, access to the world than you and I do. And then they get a little illness, and where do they head off? To the men in white, and then you find out that they've been killed because of the injections or the medication went wrong and what have you. So when you see that kind of level of unbelievable ignorance in just that one area that people still are trusting, the allopathic system, well then you see, that's why it's very obvious to me that same kind of backwardness and blinkeredness is in all the other aspects of what the establishment is doing, including the media. I'm happy to see that in recent times, people are jumping up and saying, yes, Michael, we see these symbols, we're working on it, we're putting this stuff together. But this is very recent in history. Thousands and thousands of people have lost their lives and died because of the most brutal, treatment from these colonial powers, and it's not any different. So
Are you talking about the hospitals? So somebody goes into a hospital, let's say Kylie Minogue. Actually, let's not say anything. Let's not say any particular name. Somebody goes into a hospital with an ailment, and you're saying because of mistreatment, or is it purposeful, or is it just the way the system is set up that people are actually being killed by the very thing that they're hoping that will help them? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I was using it more as a metaphor. Both apply. I think there is some actual cause for concern that a lot of it is done deliberately. I mean, I've got a whole library of videotape material on these, what only can be described as, Dr. Frankensteins, who literally are on record of doing things, or like, for instance, the women, you have the Munchausen syndrome in reverse, where the staff will strangle children and kill them and inject them and all. So there is a conscious malignity there, but what I was really referring to is the whole allopathic leviathan, and the kind of ignorance factor that after all these years we're not up to speed on the fact that these guys are dangerous. You know what I'm saying? So obviously, that's a very obvious example.
Okay.
Then when you start thinking of other areas, you see that this pestilence exists. You start to understand that again, the level of ignorance is very high, given where we should be and where we should understand. So in our work, we're always conscious of the fact that just sketch out the background first. Background is very important even in any classroom. In any subject, you need to know the background of something. And I think it's extremely important. It's vital when you deal with people, when you start bringing up these alternative matters, because they're going to think you're completely boogaloo. And therefore, you have to sketch in the background, talk about the prison systems of the old times, the old bedlams, for instance, give them some anecdotes, give them some examples, show how old this is, sketch in some of the background that's historical, remind people of what has happened to their own forefathers, specifically in Ireland. My goodness, you'd think that these people in Ireland, could never forget what has been done to them, and yet they are. The new generation now, the new generation of teenagers, probably not even aware of what even was going on, 100 years ago. They're probably not even aware of the famine or any of these things, And certainly in European schools, the history of certain countries is no longer being taught, or it's being taught, based on some sort of a program that the United Nations has handed down.
Yeah.
People are no longer being told the facts even of a very, very short time ago, and that is absolutely horrific to know about, that the people don't know how their parents suffered in the world wars, or how much they had to sacrifice, in these things like that. Mm-hmm. So as every year goes by, we get further and further away from the past. Ergo, there's more need to sketch in some of this background when you're dealing in very controversial matters.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's some of what you're talking about, mind control.
Yep.
I like the way that the movie was actually put together. What I was curious about was there was a huge amount of reference to pop culture, Star Wars.
Oh, sure.
The Carpenter film, Superman. What was your outcome for actually having that in?
Because we're very conscious of the audience that we're talking to and what kind of frames of reference they deal with. If you start talking to people about the Sigmund Freuds and the Durants and the Nietzsches and Schopenhauers, or the Heideggers, or any of the other sort of activists, and philosophical people. You can do that to an extent, but, the people we're dealing with have not read this. Nobody has any more time to read, people in America, for instance, about 5% of them have a library card. Less than 10% of the population reads books. So you have to come across, that's like I say, meeting them halfway. You have to come across to them and use medium that is familiar to them so that they can say, I got you. Yeah, I can remember that. It's just a strategy. It's just a simple means. I enjoy it because to me, it is all artwork. It's all artwork. It's all that the mind has created. We're also getting many messages from positive people through the music and through the movies. And I find, from years and years and years of just doing talks and getting up on stage and all of that, that it works better. It just people, you know, it gets their interest more. It's not as dry and boring. I like it when I'm listening to somebody else. And so we felt it was good. Henrik is very up to speed, again, on, you know, movies and documentaries and things like that. And, you know, we wanted it to have a very stream of consciousness sort of way in which, you know, it wasn't so much a talking head. You know, we could yeah, go off into yeah. this other right brain stuff, you know. So it was kind of experimental, but it worked out great. And we've had very, very, very positive feedback about it.
Okay, and you talk about the origins of evil. Now, you do define evil. You give a sort of definition. But again, for anyone listening, quick synopsis of the origins of evil by your understanding. And a definition of evil is something that somebody mightn't think about too much.
No, they don't. And my work has really been to look at the concept of injustice and evil and sadism and psychopathy and sociopathy in a different way than the philosophers have and in a different way than the religious people of the world have, because I don't believe that they've got a handle on it at all. And therefore, this started with my Atlantis book and my researches into the ancient history to show that it was a combination of earth cataclysms. It was also a combination of some sort of transgenic experimentations that were done on the biology of human beings in ancient times that basically caused a severe trauma in the psyche. And this is backed up somewhat by some science, great scientists actually, people like Dr. Julian Jaynes and Terence McKenna. They're about the only two I can think who've even, but there are a few others, Glenn Parton and other people I mentioned in my DVD series, that looked a little bit into this. However, they stopped short at the actual roots of it. They didn't look to an earth cataclysm. They do know there's something wrong with man's psyche. They certainly know that. And they understand that there is this fragmentation that took place in the mind. But they simply don't, you know, go as far as, say, the metaphysicians do, and certainly as far as I've done, to say, no, no, this was from physical causes. Just like a car wreck or a bomb blast is known to traumatize, you know, people and put them into a shock situation. Well, this is what happened to the whole of humanity right across the world, right across the globe, and all the traditions talk about it. They may talk about it metaphorically. They may talk about it in their pantheons and their cosmologies. But basically, that trauma is there. They do mention it. And then they also mention the galvanizing forces that came along in order to try and, you know, glue the mind back together. So in my work, I've looked very deeply into all of that and discovered that the ego, what we call the ego, that's basically the part of consciousness that now controls the world, controls our lives. Mm-hmm. This ego is very young. This ego came about as a sort of a steadying action to the fractured and broken mind. It's like, imagine you break a mirror into a thousand pieces,
yeah,
or a circuit board. And there's a lot of beeping and sort of buzzing from all of these different broken parts. They're still working, so to speak, but they're not glued together. And the ego is sort of a bigger part of that circuit board that has more lights going on. It's not completely dead. And this became the center of consciousness. What was left of consciousness was the ego. And the ego, of course, by being cut off from the earth, being cut off from the divine, being cut off from the what's now referred to as the unconscious, works in some very haphazard ways. It's not the blame for doing that. It's just that this is a result of the syndrome. It's a result of the trauma, and it's a result of the shock. It acts just like a shocked creature would act, you see?
Okay.
And this ego is now in charge of the world, and so the injustices that we see do have a date of birth, this kind of way we also treat ourselves and the way we treat our fellow human beings, you see, and we treat the nature and treat the animals. Mm-hmm. Is what I define by evil. It's just a state in which man is out of center. He's not connected anymore. Like Socrates said, you know, to harm another is to harm oneself. Simple principles like that, you know, are wasted on modern humanity because something has traumatized man, and therefore he responds in a flight or fight emergency type of situation. And then the establishment co-opt this to further traumatize you through the media, through the politics, through the wars and the rumors of wars. Mm-hmm. And through all this stuff about weather and, you know, potential dangers and vaccines and flus and all of this stuff, they're constantly hitting us with a barrage to continue the traumatizing process. It's a very strong element of my work, you know.
Okay, you know something? Now I get it. So you're saying the back, way, way back in antiquity, there was some sort of cataclysm. which, in effect, traumatized every human being on the planet. And we have passed that down through, I don't know, through genetic and spiritual means. And we formed an ego as a defense, a stabilizer to that. And now the forces that be are sticking their finger in our open wound, so to speak.
A very good way to put it.
Wow. Okay, now I get it.
It's like when you're going to slip on the ice or you're going to slip on a banana peel. Yeah. One of the muscles will tighten and go spastic in order to save you from falling down, you see.
Mm.
So this is exactly what happened in an energetic way. And you're right. Our forefathers were traumatized, and then that trauma, that fear, and it includes many phobias that we have as well, got transmitted down through what's called the racial memory, and we all are born with it. Some people have it more, some people have it less. In fact, what we call schizophrenic people and people who have mental disorders, they probably are, you know, susceptible to this deeper ancestral trauma than the rest of us, who for some reason have a little bit more, you know, stabilizing because our forefathers or, you know, genetics, hereditary, whatever you want to call it. So again, this all has to be looked into. I don't have all the answers. You know, it's a tremendous study.
Okay. Wow. That's that. Yes. You know, when you finally get something, you feel like, wow. Yeah, that's
definitely
clears up a lot. And then the rest of Architects of Control, what were you painting for your audience? What were you painting? What were you creating as a back set?
Well, very much in our minds, you see, is this countdown to 2012 and the so-called, you know, destiny of humankind. And we're in a race to the finish, and it's looking like, you know, the good people of the world are itching for a proper civilization of truth, justice, and freedom. And then we have this other coterie who are demented, sociopathic, traumatized. You know, the people who lead, the people who rule, these are very demented, dark souls. And they're rushing to create their dystopia. And through means like technology, as well as other forms of mind control and so on, they're building this every day. And they're co-opting us through the media. The media is merely their carrot. Mm. And the technologies and surveillance systems and the trauma is the stick. And they're goading us down into their global village type situation. And you see elements of this in the films and so forth and so on. And you certainly see it in the corporate world where they're really pushing for this. And of course, they always sweeten it up. Because technology in itself is not bad, it's a good thing, and you know they know how to sweeten it up. But behind that is this move to dehumanize the human being and get rid of the being and just have the human, sort of this robotic type of creature. And 2012 has always been posited as a date in which it might be the end of the world or end of time or whatever. And of course it's not the end of time, but it might be the end of history. It might be the end of what we have grown up with. It might be the end of the way that our forefathers have known the world, in which we are so siliconized, so artificialized, that we don't even have any connection to nature anymore in a true way. We don't have connection to our bodies anymore. You know, it's like somebody already said that most communications that are done today are done by way of a certain gadget, just like you and I are talking right now. Mm. Face-to-face conversation, you know, could be on its way out, that you're always going to have some sort of interface, technical interface. So, again, it's very, very much a problem. And if we don't work... If we look forward and we see that this particular dystopia could come about, that's what, you know, Henrik and I are interested in. We want to look at the positive and negative aspects of that and understand why man brings these kinds of realities into his being, because this kind of utopia has been actually predicted since the time of Francis Bacon. The Leviathan has been building it through the science of Isaac Newton. This is why they prefer a Newton, you see, over another more holistic type of scientist, you know. So there's been a selection process through the Royal Academy and Royal Societies to push technology, to push history in a certain direction through the Industrial Revolution and right up now to the modern Silicon Revolutions and so forth, and we're going to continue with that process. So we want to look at what that means for consciousness, and is actually consciousness on its way out? And what might come after 2012? Not the end of the world, but the end of man, that man might be a different creature, he might be willing to go along with the gig, because by that time, as is already happening now, he's so sick of his emotions. He doesn't want to look at his so-called dark side. He doesn't want to look at, you know, the problems, quote-unquote, that he has. And he's looking for anesthetization. He's looking for bromides, which he's always been doing in the past. But now, since the trauma is amping up, he might want to tune out, drop out even more, you see. So the system is there, and that's what Architects of Control was showing some brilliant scenes in the movie show this, that people are itching for it. They don't want to be themselves. They're not looking for freedom. They want freedom from freedom. And they're not interested in truth or justice at all. Yeah, and this is central to my work. And I want to know why that is. Is it because there's something inside people that they don't want to look at? You know, we've got to look into some of the psychology here. And then again, never forgetting of how the other side, the establishment, the plutocrats, co-opt that. Because as I said before, these plutocrats who rule the world are the most possessed and most demonic of people. So obviously, even though they talk about order a great deal, order is the last thing they really want. They use the world, New World Order, but order has nothing to do with it. They're actually in a state of inner psychic chaos. And they don't mind the world in a state of physical chaos either, which is why they're constantly, you know, pulling the rug and constantly, you know, rattling the sabers and constantly putting these three-headed monsters at our gates to scare the bejesus out of everybody, because they want a world of chaos. They don't want a world of order. It's just that, and the order that they will establish will be the draconian Orwellian order that keeps everybody in line, because there's another part to the psychopathic mind, and that is that they can't stand anything spontaneous, anything natural, anything organic, and anything mutable. Therefore, they want everything regimented and uniform. You see, this was always shown by George Orwell in the past, and has been shown by anyone who's looked into these matters, that there is this uniformity. But our concern, me and Henrik and Frederick, is that the uniformity starts in the mind. People's thinking about themselves, people's thinking about the world, the ego's own ideas about itself, etc., etc. These become uniform. There becomes a hive mentality, a consensus trance in thinking, in thought. And right now, when you look around the world, that's what you see. You see people, becoming like basically of the hive mentality. And this is because they've been slowly and slowly, you know, manipulated into this way of having the same thoughts, the same clothes, the same hairstyles, the same interests, and all the rest of it. And if we continue that way, then, you know, there's not going to be any glowing, you know, utopia. There will be a very serious situation in which man is literally so divorced from his center, so robotic and artificial, inhabiting artificial malls, sitting under artificial lights, taking in artificial produce, and eating artificial foods that are probably going to be entirely genetically modified, you see, and all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so the human being as we know it is going to be kaput. So we could be, as the Maya and other philosophers have predicted, and I have all their quotes in my work, we really could be at the twilight zone. We could be approaching the precipice of the end of humanity. That's basically the, you know, the bigger themes that we're working with here.
Mm. Okay. So it's by design, not accident, that the world is the way it is, and there's people behind controlling most, if not every, outcome to their own gain and their own design.
That's right. And some of the teaching and training is in your face. And the most sinister part of it is outside your frame of reference. It's outside your peripheral vision. It's like, imagine in the middle of Africa, there's an anthill.
Yeah.
If you come in with a stick and start probing around in that anthill, that's one kind of control. It's like a person training a dog face to face. That's one kind of control. But the architects of control know how to change our habitat in ways that the little ant in the hive has no grasp of at all. He's not even aware. It's like the fish is in water, but he doesn't really understand what it's all about. So the changing of the habitat has been going on for thousands of years. And that's what we wanted to do in program one, is to introduce that to people who have never conceived of that before. Yeah, they don't like their teachers. Yeah, they don't like the job they're going to. Yeah, they know that they hate the talking heads on TV. And yes, they're a bit, you know, pissed off about the way things are going politically. But that's, again, in the 3D, five senses world. And they're getting a grasp on that. Are they aware of the more subtle forms of control that exist outside that peripheral vision? A lot of people are not familiar with that. They don't have a grasp on how that's going on. In fact, many of even the people within politics, the very talking heads that you see, the Tony Blairs, the Margaret Thatchers, they themselves are under control. They're at the very lowest level of the pyramid, drunk with power, drunk with hunger for, you know, status and reputation and money and all the rest of it. Just can't be, you know, satisfied until they're on their knees in front of the queen or whatever it is, you know, getting some sort of accolade. So it works on all sorts of levels. They're not the architects of control. They are puppets themselves. And they're infected by the same kind of thing. Then they infect us. They put their people in the seats of power in the government. and in politics and the local councils and what have you, in the schools, and then it filters down into the minds of the children, you see?
Yes.
So there's a lot of this peripheral control that even people far up the ladder are not aware exists and will try to argue to you that, oh, it's just random, it doesn't have any meaning at all.
Is that what you mean by change the habitat, what you've just explained?
Yeah, the habitat has been so changed that even some people who have status within it aren't aware of it. They just got more cushions. They just got more comforts. Okay. They just got chains of gold instead of chains of iron. You know, and of course, we always know that in history and politics, there's always turncoats, that no enemy could ever destroy a group unless that group was already infiltrated. 90% of the reasons why, you know, strong groups topple is because of some people from within. Mm-hmm. So this is what you have. You have people that can work both on the good side and it can work on the bad side. So these agent provocateurs who work for the Illuminati and work for these Masonic orgs, a lot of them are not conscious of what's really going on, you see. So a lot of my books are written for them as well. In fact, the entire Irish Origins DVD series opens with a message to insiders. I have a sort of a message for them, as well as I do for the beginners and the more seasoned. I have a message for the insiders, which is wake up, find out what's going on in the corporations for which you work, take note of the injustices that are happening, and leak it and do something about it, because you're in an absolutely brilliant position. And this is what's happening more and more. You're finding police chiefs, and you're finding people in government who are coming out to tell you the truth. Like right now, somebody's just in Washington's come out to say that, you know, Obama worked for, Bin Laden worked for, you know, the American government right up to the time of 9/11. And we have these whistleblowers, and when it comes from inside the system, it's very, very powerful. And so I encourage that to happen, and I think that will be happening more. And it's one of the great, important things to look for is insiders who just can't take it anymore. And then they start to see so many lies. They have no job security anyway. So there's nothing to lose except leaking the truth. And I want to transmit that to people, because otherwise, again, they think you're boogaloo. But if you use a lot of, anecdotes from the absolute 3D physical world that they can get their teeth into, and they can really see this is a fact, this happened. Assassinations here, revelations there, especially with 9/11 and especially with other subjects pertaining to what's been happening in the last couple of years. People get with it. They start to slowly acclimatize themselves to a new way of looking at life, and they get over the trauma and they get into saying, well, what can we really do about it, you see? And then, you know, job of a person like myself is to also offer potential solutions as to what to do about it, as I've done. With my Constitution Con article and all the other work I've done, I've offered lots and lots of solutions about what can be done when people, finally wake up to realize they have the power. The architects of control have control, but they don't have the power. The human being has the power.
And solutions I'm very interested in. You mentioned the word revelation, and it was enough to, remind me of, in the architects of control, you made a reference to, in the context of mind control, you made reference to Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, and the revelations he made in court. What were these revelations?
That he worked for some... it was a mixed bag, of course, just like it was with Dennis Nelson and many others. Sutcliffe always said he was possessed. He used to work as a grave digger when he was very, very poor. And he said that it was when he was digging the graves that he started to hear, what he thought was the voice of the God, but of course he was never quite sure that maybe it was the voice of the devil. But what we were trying to point out in the Architects of Control, with the David Berkowitzes and all of these other sort of famous cases, is that a lot of them have military backgrounds, or they work for some sort of, establishment.
Yeah, but Michael, what was the revelation, or the revelations that Sutcliffe made in court? Was it that he was possessed, or what?
Yeah.
What else?
Oh yeah, just simply that he was possessed, and he heard voices, and the voices told him what to do, and that kind of thing. And he also was a man who went around. He actually bugged the author Martin Short, who wrote the book Inside the Brotherhood. He was contacted by Peter Sutcliffe, who wanted to sit down and talk with him, and he started to bug him and come around his door. And as a matter of fact, Peter Sutcliffe actually tried to run him down in a car.
Okay.
I mean, he literally stalked Martin Short. So there's a very interesting Freemasonic tie-in that even Martin Short's kind of puzzled as what on earth was going on there. And it looks like that this guy Sutcliffe was literally on the payroll. He was a paid assassin. He was a person who was working for the secret establishment or MI6 or whatever. And he was basically, I believe, just like a few others that are considered child molesters and people who, you know, have long histories of crime, very serious crime, and then who get locked up, but then they're suddenly found hanging in their cells. There's many examples of this. These are people who actually work for the establishment, were given a lot of money, were able to set up, you know, child abduction rings and what have you, and satanic rings, but they kind of went to their head, and then finally they come up against the authority figures, other cops who may not know that this is going on, and then they're taken out. You see, so there's a history timeline of that as well. And then, of course, the media puts it before you as always just a solo guy, the solo people. You know, they're just crazy. This went on for years and nobody ever found out about it, you know. But, of course, the true story is something so much more fascinating. You know, I could write a whole book on just these crimes of the past. It's really fascinating if you go back in history. I recommend the work of Colin Wilson. He also did a lot of work on the very serious criminals of the, going back in even the ancient times. Going into concepts like vampirism and sexual abuse and all sorts of cult activity and what have you. So there's a whole question there. And I believe that many of these people, like the Peter Sutcliffes and the Dennis Nilsons of the world, especially in an American context, are in fact members of some sort of black lodge. And, you know, people like Richard Ramirez and what have you. David Berkowitz has already gone on record to say that he was. That's why we had that clip in the film.
Yeah, Berkowitz, you know, I found that interesting. Berkowitz, from that reference that you made in the movie, I thought, okay, I'll do a little very, very cursory reference or research into Berkowitz. And I found a 2009 interview with Berkowitz. And he was talking about how he found Jesus. And I don't know, Jesus must have been lost walking through the prison. And Berkowitz found him. I don't know. But anyway, it's the usual conversion story.
Sure, sure.
But what I found interesting was that you said that Berkowitz was revealing facts from prison about the inner workings of these cults or who he had been related and associated with. Now, if I were his handler and he started talking, I would have him taken out if I were.
They tried to.
Okay.
We didn't have time to go into his incredible biography of this man.
Mm.
And he started making revelations quite early, but he did it piecemeal. And okay, the reason why he did it, because the conversion that you're talking about is way later in the day. His revelations were already made from the very earliest times, but he had to do it very, very slowly. And they moved him. They actually moved him out of New York to a much more remote prison. They put him in solitary. They did everything that they could to stop him from talking to these police people and to the people that, you know, he finally ended up revealing this to. It's all in the book, but it's a voluminous book, and it's a long story, of course. And what happened was, you see, that Berkowitz was very concerned for his parents. He was adopted when he was a child by two Jewish parents that he loved very dearly. He never knew who his real parents were.
Okay.
And he was worried that the people that he was talking about, just like you said, would go after his elderly parents. So okay, he was very cautious not to release the full information until they died. And in the 80s, they passed away, and then he started coming forth more. He was in fear of his own life, but of course he was in, at that point, he wanted to get the truth out so that he wasn't a man thinking that he had done, you know, 11 murders or whatever it was, you know. Mm. He had killed two people or three, whoever it was.
Yep.
And he was sorry about that. But obviously he was thinking, I'm not going to take the whole rap here, you know, and the world needs to know about this. So he started doing it, but he did it slowly because he was concerned about his elderly parents who just couldn't grasp any of this. And they were already traumatized enough by the fact that their son had been arrested.
Yep.
And he wasn't a bad man. He was an indoctrinated, simple guy who was, you know, recruited by some very sinister forces. He tried to leave. He tried to back out, but they'd already got him, you know, involved with these kinds of things. And it's a fascinating story. And basically everyone in the cult, see, you're quite right. Everybody else in the cult, even his recruiters, were all killed.
Really?
They killed each other off and they were taken out. I think only one of the main assassins was able to live on for a while. He took refuge, of all places, in Cielo Drive, down the street from where he would later be involved in the Manson killings, because Manson was a tentacle of the same a cult that Berkowitz belonged to, and the hitmen used to hang out with Mama Cass of the Mamas and Papas, you know, the heavy set lady, the heavy lady who sang.
Wow.
She was a bona fide satanic person deeply involved in child prostitution and heavy drugs, and her house was one of the houses on Cielo Drive, no less, where the Folgers lived, where Sharon Tate hung out, where Roman Polanski's family were. They were all involved in child porn and kiddie porn, and they were all taking drugs from this cult. This cult was their drug connection and their kiddie porn connection. And when they weren't paying their debts, because they, of course, were very rich, they were part of the celebrities of Los Angeles, yeah, this cult was not only losing money, but they thought if they let the Folgers and Polanski and all these other people get away with it, well, then, you know, nobody will be paying them. Nobody will be, coming up. So they actually picked Charles Manson to go and slaughter these people to make it very gruesome so that everybody else that they were dealing with, these are rock stars, these are heavy-duty politicians, these are people in the media, mm-hmm, they're the talking heads on CNN, and many other people that Berkowitz tried to list, and that even Anton LaVey and other Satanists have admitted were members of their cults, they were going to pay up or they would be shut up, you see. So Helter Skelter, which was the Manson thing, was put in front in the media to make it look like the lone crazy nut, mm-hmm, when in fact he was actually well tied in with and was recruited by the same gang that had to move out of New York because of the Berkowitz killings. That it got too hot for them there, so they moved to the West Coast. And they moved by way of Atlanta, and they also were connected to very military bases. This is where they got the guns and the ammunition from. Mm-hmm. And their killers took refuge in Los Angeles and so forth and so on, and many satanic killings were done there. And Maury Terry, who was Berkowitz's journalist friend, the guy who chronicled all of this, asked the lawyer Vincent Bugliosi, the man who prosecuted Manson, you know, don't you, that this is not about Manson and Helter Skelter, you know it's about ? And he mentioned the cult, and he mentioned the whole New York Son of Sam thing. And Vincent Bugliosi is on record to say, sure I do. But if I go to the court with that, Maury, if I take this to the American people, Manson will be walking because they'll think I'm a nut and he'll get off. I've got to go with Helter Skelter. I've got to go with him and his little creepy cult, because then at least I can get him booked and I can get him to go, you know, sentenced for life. If I start bringing up satanic cults and stuff like that, they're going to laugh me out of court. But I know as well as you do that it's a hell of a lot more than that. It's on record.
Wow. Good Lord.
It's an incredible story.
I'm glad I asked you that particular question. God, I lost the next question. Zero tolerance for the lie. What is the lie?
Well, the lie is all around you. The lie is the constant infection that in any shape or form, gets you off your center, confuses your mind. It's exactly the same as if somebody was literally putting poison in your soup. It's no different than some teacher in a classroom who's laying on you his own personal prejudices, mm-hmm, and his own personal, nonsense about politics or whatever. You just don't have tolerance for that. You go, look, I'm going to report you. What you're talking about is utter rubbish, or these comments you've made are utterly preposterous. You know, so it's the same idea, but on a bigger level. Have zero tolerance for all that pestilence that comes over the media, that comes, like I said, is in the consensus trance, that other people might buy into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of it. Have zero tolerance for it. That's a kind of an immunity. That's a kind of a defense. There's going to be positive defensiveness. In the same way that you have defensiveness when you lock your house and put your, alarm on or whatever, or you lock your car. We do this every day. We protect our goods. We protect our belongings. What about our minds? Our minds are completely open to all the rubbish and all the viral, messages that are just pouring in.
Yep.
Most of it just bogus. One of them is, of course, half-truths, mistruths about history, and so forth and so on. So, it's a long list, and people like me, we work in that field. We try to bring up to people, we're not siding with any point of view. We're not forcing anyone. I study these things because I like to. Other people who follow my work also like it, and we all study it together. It doesn't mean we have to have lunch together and we have to know each other and all of this thing. There's no cults. There's no sects. There's no groups. There's no territorialization of this knowledge. There's no experts. We're just looking at this knowledge in a different way. We're trying to adjust our settings so that we see life as it really is. And one of those aspects is to really, have a very strong critical judgment, because criticism and judgment is frowned upon today. They say you're negative. Oh, you're so dark. You're so pessimistic. No, I'm critical. I'm skeptical, and so forth and so on. And that's good to be. We want to sharpen those abilities. And the children right now, the young, are just completely dumbed down. They're being hit by just barrages of pre-digested lies, and they don't even know it because the mental faculty is not working anymore. It's frozen with trauma. It's frozen with overstimuli from the world and from the media. And, again, it adds up to the fact that, if this is the way things continue, then, you know, around about 2012, 2015, whatever, you know, we're going to be in a very sorry state as human beings. The Earth will be in a sorry state, and mankind will be in a very sorry state.
Okay, how do we change that? You talk about critical thinking and sharpening your ability to reason, develop your consciousness, and thus develop an immunity to those irrational external and indeed irrational internal attacks. How do you develop those? What techniques, what methods? Do you do meditation, Michael? Do you do energy work? Do you do Qigong? If anyone's listening and would, obviously they look around the planet and they go, something isn't quite right here. They maybe can't put their finger on it. Your work will help to unravel the perception, but we also need to step in with, okay, here's the solution. Once you know what it is you're looking at, we also need the solution. So how do you develop, Michael? What do you do?
Well, see, first of all, our work in the professional setting, in the eyes of the world, we're just putting up signposts.
Mm-hmm.
We can't walk the walk for people, nor do we intend to do that. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not a guru. I'm not a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I just put up signposts, and people can either walk that road or they can decide to go down some other road. You know, I, again, do this because this is my meditation, looking at the world this way, you know, trying to take very esoteric matters and bring it down to a practical format for even beginners. And, you know, I've done that with my mystery school. I've done that with the books I've written. You know, I'm always working from the grassroots level. I think that it's not that difficult to build up psychic immunity once you start. It's a pleasure because, remember, you're being backed up by your own unconscious mind. When anyone who's physical speaks the truth outside, he is actually speaking, and there's an echo, there's a resonance in a person's unconscious. So the truth is very powerful because anybody who speaks the truth outside, they're speaking what your own inner soul is also speaking. So it's like two forces pushing at this thin wall, and eventually that wall will break down. The lie, however, you know, is just from the outside. And it has no power except if you want to believe it. So the idea is that by going to work such as ours, by checking out the references like you've already said that you did, by, you know, tracking the references, by getting interested again in life, not being bored, understanding there's a great miracle of life, realizing that you are on this planet, you may know at the very most 70 summers and then it's over. You know, time, man is against us, man's world is against us, and also time is against us. And so there's not a moment to lose. And therefore, you know, getting interested and getting passionate about art and about life and about literature and the meaning of life, this is something you can't instill in somebody. So my work, therefore, goes out to those people, you know, who are already doing that, who already have that kind of interest and that passion, and they are critical, and they can, you know, they can get with this kind of gig. I know that I'm only talking to a very small group of the world, and that's never daunted me. That's fine. I'm glad for even the, you know, the certain publicity that I've got. So I'm contented. I'm happy. You know, and again, I'm not there to tell other people what to do, nor am I disenchanted with the way things are. Because when you pull back from the canvas and you realize that there are these cycles, there's the winter cycle, just like there's the summer cycle, there is a catabolic plutonic cycle, and that's okay for decay and things to corrupt. And remember, that which is true and that which is inviolable cannot be destroyed. If you see something being destroyed, it probably has to be destroyed because it's not strong, it's not sound, it's not real. It has to pass through these cycles. And man's mind is the same. Man's thinking, his civilizations, his societies, they are corrupt, they are rotten, they are littered with injustice. So if we turn up to be in a cycle like now we are, like the Maya predicted, the age of revealing, the age when the masks are coming down, you know, I'm perfectly okay with that. I'm perfectly okay with apocalypse because I cannot stand injustice and I will not stand it. And, you know, I'm not going to start wanting to dream about, you know, paradisical utopias when I see all this injustice and death and misery around me in the world. And if the forces of, the, you know, hygiene come in to clean that up, I am okay with that. Of course, that's very troublesome to other people. So the meditation that I would recommend for people is to go back to nature, to look at the animal cycle, to understand that there is this catabolic death cycle, and to be okay again with that, just as the ancient druids were, just like the ancient peoples were. They understood that the fields and the trees and nature goes through these catabolic cycles. It's not really a death, it's more a deconstruction. And that there's a time comes when that's okay. It's okay to have a fallow mind. It's okay to have less. It's okay to think in deconstructive models, you see. And mankind has not been able to do that because we've been so overcompensated, you know, by the other kind of model of gain, have, attain, want, and grab, you know, and all of these kinds of things. Mm. But see, those days are dying fast. The political manifestation is recession, and, you know, things cutting back and all of that, and so on. But there's also a psychological connection as well, in which people lose, jettison, that which is not serving them anymore. And, you know, that's perfectly okay with that. No teacher of the mysteries is going to be having a problem with that. It's very necessary, because people are carrying around a lot of psychic baggage. You know, and again, on the individual level, my God, there's so many things that can help you. It's not an A to Z. No one can say, this is what I do, therefore, you know, you should do it too. But yeah, Qigong, Feng Shui, Vastu, walking in nature, martial arts, you know.
Vastu. What's Vastu?
Vastu is the Indian form of Feng Shui.
Okay, okay.
It's debatable which one came first. Vastu, but in a geomancy, you can extend even to the way you design a house, or where you even place your house, or the places you choose to live. You know, it has multiple, it's your diet, it can be your health. I mean, not for everybody. Some people are more susceptible to the poisoning of the world because they're eating wrong food, and maybe they need to change that, whereas another person is more thick-skinned, and they can get away with it. It's not a big problem. You know, but they may need to fix something else in their life. Or it could be in their relationships. See, the message of truth is always going to be in your life. You don't even need to look beyond the garden gate. All the particular challenges that you need to go through are right in your life. They're right in your mind. They're right in your home. They're in your interactions with the people that you deal with. They're your mirror, and you're their mirror. And it works right there from the most, you know, basic level, and then it moves out from that point on.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, Michael. Totally agree with you there. And the people behind the Black Lodge, that's what you call them, right?
Yeah.
Who are these people? I mean, I've heard names thrown out by different researchers like Mr. David Icke, I suppose our own Jim Corr right here in Ireland, the usual, the Bilderberg Group and the Rothschilds. But who's behind those people? Is there a dark entity on this planet, or is it just simply fractured, demented human beings?
It's both, of course.
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, down on the lower levels of the pyramid, as we said, you know, there is this sort of orchestrated chaos.
Yeah.
This is to use their own terms, by the way. It's nothing we've made up.
Right.
But as you go further up the pyramid, you know, you get to find out what it's really all going on. This is what my work specializes in. This is what my Astrotheology and Atlantis book and Irish Origins book is all about. Looking at the very highest parts of this pyramid, the Atlantis book talked about the off-world presences who also may be behind this, the Nephilim, the fallen angels that are mentioned in many scriptures throughout the world. But even if we want to move to more of the human dimension, then the story picks up in Egypt at a particular time in Egypt with a group that I refer to as the Atenists. This is the time of Akhenaten and his mystery schools. Akhenaten was basically one of the chiefs of this Black Lodge. They were sun worshippers, so it sounds like a paradox until you realize that sunlight also has some negative principles. Light can blind you as much as it can illuminate for you. And the next time a cop shines a light in your face, you'll soon realize what I mean. So light is used in very destructive ways by these illuminists, by these people that refer to themselves as the princes of light. And these are, they can be referred to as Judites, although that is not the same meaning as the common word that we use Jew when we're talking about religious Jews. The Queen of England, the highest royal families in the world consider themselves Judites, but they don't consider themselves religious Jews. They can be Protestants or they can be Catholics, but they actually can still be Judites. The Pope in Rome is a Judite. That's why he's wearing Jewish symbols. He's wearing Judaic symbols. And Jews will, you know, complain about that, or they might like it. Catholics will go, oh, no, 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 that's got nothing to do with it. Because, again, the references and the words have been so misappropriated and mistranslated that when you say these words, people, you know, completely fooled about what you're saying. It's like my book, Irish Origins of Civilization. They think I'm talking about Ireland and the Irish. I am, partly, but not in the way that most people think. The word Irish comes from the word Aryan, which was a worldwide, you know, group of elders that stretched all the way from India right across into Scandinavia and in Ireland. So this is the Irish, or the Arya specifically. Ireland is just the name of one small country on the west coast.
Mm-hmm.
On the western seaboard, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the elders, you know, who once were the children of the keepers of truth. So again, always the terms have to be defined. But the Judites, or the Tudor family, the Plantagenets, you know, they go back to the through all the royal dynasties, most of the most powerful ones like the Habsburgs and Hanoverans and Merovingians and the Savoy family and the Bourbons out of France. You see, you're talking about people like Robert de Guise and Charles de Lorraine, who were behind the Illuminati. So again, when you talk about Freemasons, Templars, and Illuminati, those three threads always go back to the Merovingian dynasties that came out of France, specifically out of Champagne and out of Burgundy. They themselves come out of a group known as the Merovingians, who themselves come out of a group called the Sicambri Franks. And Franks doesn't mean French, it means the Germans. There's a German Merovingian group of very, very powerful wizards, magi, kings.
Now, the magi wizards, would they fall under the sorcery or the magic camp?
Oh, these guys are sorcerers.
So, okay.
Oh,
so,
yeah. And these Merovingians may be even connected to a group called the Amaru, because the Mero or Meru word root is very, very significant. It means the men of the sea. It means other things as well. And the Merovingians may go back to the Amaru or the Meru of Babylon and that area.
Okay.
They may themselves be connected to the Celts. A group of Celts called the Scythians, you see. The Scythians go back to the Hyksos of Egypt. And it's from the Hyksos line of sun kings that Akhenaten and Thutmose, his fathers, came. So there is actually a bona fide thread that can be followed. There's nothing spurious about it. But the fascinating stuff is when you start to discover how this unseen, because as you're saying, they're invisible. They're not a lot of people know about these, you know, dynasties and how old they are. But these dynasties connect to not only the Athenian potentates of Athens and Greece, but they definitely connect to the Caesars and emperors of Rome, people that have always been put before us in history books as working independently, autonomously. But that's not true. People like Tony Bushby and many other authors have proven that the British element was very strong in Rome, and even from the earliest days, they actually had a place called the Palace of the Britons. And the Palace of the Britons is where the most powerful Caesars, people like Augustus and Nero and others, used to languish. This is where they used to go and meet their mates from Britain, who were actually more powerful than them. I believe they actually funded the Caesars. Okay. This is where pharaohs, people from Egypt, would gather. This is where all the elites of the world would meet in Roma. And Rome is actually created. People have got to get the dates right. Rome was established 700 BC. That's not a long time ago. I mean, you're talking about, you know, some people say the Milesians, who are the Atenists I'm talking about, arrive in Ireland about 550 BC. I actually believe they may have arrived here a lot earlier than that, even 1,000. But even if it's 1,000 BC, you're within a stone's throw of the time of Rome rising, of the time of the Caesars going back into Egypt, you see, to desecrate the libraries of Alexandria and try to seize Egypt by the sword, the destruction of the Gauls, the destruction of the Nords, the destruction of the Vikings, the proto-Vikings, and the movement of the Roman army. And what happens if that movement of the Roman army throughout the world was actually just a mercenary action funded by the very kings of Egypt that I'm telling you that, you know, were thrown out of Egypt? Akhenaten and his group were thrown out, you see, and they just fall off the map. But now it has been conclusively proven by great authors like Ralph Ellis and Mustafa Gadella and Ahmed Osman that those so-called renegade pharaohs were nothing less than the Israelites mentioned in the Bible, in other words, the Judites. But not, again, as an ordinary dictionary definition or as an ordinary religious person has heard those terms. A Jew today is a man from any race, any background, any blood, black, white, Mongolian, converted in recent times to the Jewish religion. That is not the kind of person we're talking about. We're talking about the proto-Zionists. And by the way, the word Zion was a capital in Egypt. That was one of the capitals of these Atenists. It was actually called Sion or Zion. One of the headquarters and city in Switzerland is called Sion. You can look it up on Wikipedia, S-I-O-N, and it was founded by the Knights Templars, who are nothing more than an offshoot of the same Merovingian French dynasties that we've just been talking about. So this word Sion, or priory to Sion, these high steering committees of the Freemasons and Knights Templars, all date back, their symbolism and their iconography, all dates back to Egypt. There's even a city there called that. So these people have a long ancestry, and they are powerful, and they've never gone away. Their bloodline still exists. But my work always says that even if you meet people today, like certain royal families, and they may not be bloodline, they may not be biologically connected to these ancient strains of dynasties, mm-hmm. they are ideologically connected, meaning that they are servants of these forces. Okay. These forces stay in the background, and the modern people today, the modern kings and dukes and princes, and the people that they hire and the people that they put in the orgs, they are absolutely solar worshippers. They're all Luciferians, and they all operate in allegiance to this particular Black Lodge that is very secretive and that my work, you know, has gone into trying to expose.
Okay. Any magicians left on the planet?
Yeah, of course there are, you know.
And obviously. how would somebody know if they were a magician but weren't actually practicing yet as a magician but had the potential, the pure potential to be a magician?
Wow, that's an unanswerable question, really. Because remember, the magician has a path that he walks that is not like anybody else's, so it's very likely that he won't know who he is, that his identity will be hidden from himself, and that maybe even other people will see it before he does. What I mean is that in the movie Dune, you'll notice that in the film and the book, when they're trying to avoid the worms, they have to walk without rhythm.
Yeah.
If you watch a movie again, there's this incredible scene as they're negotiating the serpent, in other words, the malign presence. They have to walk across the desert without rhythm. So the unorthodox, like in the Tower of Cards, you have the fool. This kind of person who lives on the edge, who doesn't really know or even care what's happening tomorrow, who lives spontaneously, who is guided by some inner force, meaning he's inner directed as opposed to outer directed. Mm-hmm. He's spontaneous, he's mutable, he's youthful, he's open-minded, he's vulnerable, but he's intelligent. You know, it's very much like a sort of Tom Sawyer character, you know, like the band Rush have mentioned in their lyrics, this kind of analog man. We got to understand that he is not really looking for flowers and speeches or crowns on his head. He will not understand that he is a precious jewel. That's just the way it is. In fact, that's part of his attraction. He's not looking for any kind of accolades, and he shouldn't. He should just do his own thing in his own way, and he shouldn't give a damn about what other people say, think, and do. This is very much the opening preface of the book that he should read. Because if he cares about what other people think, say, and do, he's not going to get very far. He'll be ruined and destroyed very quickly. So that might sound cold, but actually, it's a fact. You have to operate on that manual, because if you don't, you'll be seduced. The world will eat you alive.
Or you'll be seduced into the other camp.
Absolutely, which is very possible. And of course, it's almost like, you see, there are people who have inner light, they're lit from within, and then the rest of the world is like they're reflectors of that person's light. I know it sounds a bit like Hegelian here, but there are morally superior people. In the talk that I did at Liverpool, in the Beyond Knowledge Conference, I ended on that note. I was in Liverpool, you know, so I was making reference to people like John Lennon, you know, just to keep him happy. No, only kidding. But no, I was talking about, you know, the great men, the great musicians, the great authors, you know, and the great lights, of which Ireland has so many, you can't even count. So the idea being that there are certain people who are lit from within, and then there's the reflectors of other people's light who are not yet lit from within. And you find that they are the movers and the shakers. It's almost like you have a China vase, a Ming vase. Well, it's going to come in a box full of peanuts. Well, I know it sounds cold to say it, but a lot of people walking around, they're just the packing straw. They are literally just the peanuts. That's just the way it is. You know, because I, from a psychological background, I'm not religious, so I don't believe people come into this world with a soul. I'm into psychology, and I believe that man creates his soul while he's here alive. He will do that by maybe going to look at what religion has for him, taking parts of that. He may go towards other philosophies, you know, and so forth and so on. But he's not going to become a fanatic and say, oh, this guru, this priest, this god is going to do it all for me. I don't need to do anything. No, that man is going to be always seeking. He's always going to have the mind of a beginner. And he is that precious pearl. You know, he's that precious vase that sits amongst the straw. It's just the way it is. And, you know, if he's worrying about what that those peanuts and that straw is thinking of him, he's never, ever going to make it, you know, through all the obstacles that come, because the Siddhartha road is very hard to walk. It has a lot of challenges on it. And therefore, it's very good to, you know, be aware of that and strengthen your own immunity, you know. But basically, you see, the way I look at it now, since I've become actually more of a public figure, is that the people who are in the know, they never contact you. These are people who just are out there, they listen to what you say, they got it, they don't need explanations because they have it already. And the people who come to you are mostly in the beginning stages, and they need the guidance, they need the signposts, and that's fine. That's why, you know, we work in the public eye and use the public platform, you know, to, you know, sort of let them know, you know, the things that I've discovered over the years.
Okay. Wow. Magicians, for any magicians out there listening, just take it on board what Michael just said, and stay in your own center. Now, Michael, I loved the movie, Architects of Control. Like what you did. A lot of the stuff that you talk about, and you do talk sometimes high concept and don't get down into detail, but that's, you're a philosopher, right? So that's what you do. Now, there was Michael Ryan, the Hungerford Massacre. I just want to bring something back to you for your own, consideration. We went off to do a little bit of research on Michael Ryan. Now, and again, it was in relation and in context to the mind control. And you used Michael Ryan as an example, almost like the flagship of mind control. And you said that he went on a killing spree. He received a call from a specialist half an hour before he goes on his killing spree. It was recorded. Now, we couldn't find any documentation on that. And then you said that Michael kills himself after the head detective makes his way to where Michael Ryan is held up, and with the use of a loudspeaker bullhorn to coax him, we hear a single shot. Seemingly, oh good Lord, I've lost my train of thought. Isn't this great? Anyway, there was some discrepancy on. Between what you had said about Michael Ryan and what actually happened, seemingly it was an hour and a half of a siege. What do you say to that?
How long ago it was since I'd looked into that, and I was more speaking generally about the kind of way that these things happen. I wasn't really speaking specifically about his data. The anecdote about him being called on the phone was in the very first BBC documentary on him.
Okay.
I saw that in England, in Ireland. And I made a mental note of it, and it was absolutely, it wasn't on anything to do with, you know, serial killers worldwide. In fact, by the time I saw that, there wasn't any such documentaries, you know.
Right.
Certainly weren't as common. So this stood out because I always try to catch things. This has only become vogue in the last sort of like 5-10 years kind of thing. I've been into this since the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
When it was only in magazines, the Observer magazine on Sunday, you know, I'd get it. And I'd try to get my parents to keep this information. So I'd like reaching the ceiling of all sorts of magazines that contained these stories, you know, and there was no internet. If it was a TV program, you were lucky to even have a videotape. You know, I was so poor, I didn't even have a videotape. Exactly, you know. Sure, you know, it was the same for a lot of people where I lived. So obviously, you know, you have made a mental note of it and often wrote it down.
Right.
So I wasn't really specifically, you know, talking about the ins and outs of that one. I was given more general background information about the way these trigger terms are used. And it's sort of like more the way this is habitually done. Each individual, you know, episode is slightly different, of course.
Yes.
You know, but the general principles are there. There's even been a movie made on this. That's very, very good, with the Charles Bronson. The name doesn't jump to mind. It could be called Target or something like that. Target.
The real Charles Bronson.
It's an early Charles Bronson movie. His wife is in it, Jill Ireland.
Okay.
And it's absolutely about mind control from the federal FBI, CIA level.
Okay.
And it has very, in fact, one of the clips from that we use in the Architects of Control when we're talking about the Hungerford killing.
Mm.
There's an excellent image of a hunter guy getting into his truck, or he's a mechanic, and he receives a phone call. People watch the DVD, they'll see it, and he gets into his truck and he smashes it into a big building.
Yes.
That's from that movie. So I don't know if Henrik mentioned the movie. he probably did in the credits at the end of Architects of Control. People can go on there and check it out. That movie is really well worth seeing because it shows you how they do it. But even in the, do you know how many whistleblowing shows there have been on this? For instance, even The Professionals, remember that show?
Yeah.
The Professionals. Over in America, we have Hawaii 5-0. We've had The Rockford Files. We have shows in which they whistleblow this. They literally tell you how it's done, and they're the ones making it.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, it's like you have to have a syncretic mind to put all this stuff together. You have to adjust your settings. You have to believe your intuition. You have to follow the traces. I had loads of information on all of this stuff, and I've really studied. I mean, I've really studied criminology. I basically, you know, bought every book Colin Wilson's ever written, and I had a crate of books on this subject. I assiduously studied them, all the history of crime throughout the world, all the history of mind control, the Jim Keith material, and just so much other stuff. And so this is the problem, you know, when somebody like me, we're into the world of sound bites, unfortunately, even though we produce our own stuff. And one of the reasons we do produce our own stuff is so that you don't have to cut it up so small and you don't have to edit. But there still is a certain amount of editing that needs to be done in these DVDs. Otherwise, Jesus, it just goes on and on and on and would never stop. So, you know, it's encyclopedic. And the knowledge I've got is encyclopedic. I mean, this is one of the issues that, you know, Henrik and the people I work with have a problem with, is because, my God, we gotta stop somewhere here. We have to really know, okay, this is enough for this, and move on. So it's a tremendous process of dealing with this tremendous encyclopedic subject and trying to select from it enough and then not digress too much. You know, you have the same problem, I know, on your radio shows. Anyone who's in the media knows this, that if you get into too many digressions, you know, you lose your audience. So you can keep to the main theme, then maybe have one, maybe two digressions, and then you have to jump onto something else, because otherwise it gets too vague, you know. And also, I'm not here to do all the work. I want people to do like what you're doing. I want them to go and study this, because I know what they'll find. They go and research it themselves, pick up the books, you know, read it. Go and read Maury Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil and the Berkowitz Saga. Go and read Mass Control, you know, by Jim Keith. Read these works that we've mentioned. We have reference works. I've got book lists. People can contact me for them, you know. I have other movie references, like that Parallax View, you know, and all the movies that we used, clips of and Architects of Control. They should be watched. They should be studied, you know, and see that this is ubiquitous. It's actually in your face. It very much is. And there's been incredible movies even made in Ireland, like OMA and Hidden Agenda, about what's really been going on in the Irish context that millions of people in Ireland have no idea. You know, what's what. So, you know, but the information is there. The Molly Maguires and other movies I recommend. You know, people need to get with it, get passionate. It's very fascinating. It's very interesting.
Michael, can you speak to me briefly? And I mean very briefly. I'm just aware of the we're way over time, but you know something, that's okay, if you're okay with that.
Well, sure, we can go on for a bit more. I need to stop myself pretty soon, though.
Yeah, okay. Lisbon. Lisbon Treaty. What is your take within the context of what we have been talking about?
Well, there's been many treaties. You see, if you go back to the Treaty of Vienna, the Congress of Vienna, you come up to the Versailles Treaty, you know, and the Treaty of Rome, and all of these treaties, they have to have your consent. That's all I'll say about it, is that they have to have your consent. It ties back to what we were saying at the beginning of the show, when you asked your first excellent question. We invite the vampire across the threshold. And so, I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritties of it because, again, that doesn't interest me as much. These political anecdotes, there's one every month. It's endless. All I can say from an abstract point of view is that these treaties are all about you signing on the dotted line. You do it when you sign every check. You do it when you pay your taxes. Mm-hmm. It's all slavery by consent. And it can happen on a social, you know, national level, and it can happen on an individual level as well. Because when we walk towards the global utopia, we'll have the keys in our hands. We'll buy the tickets for that train ride. That's okay. The problem.
Okay. Do we have time for one more question, Michael?
Oh, yeah.
It's one that took me a long time to put together because I'm such a slow process and slightly dim. Now, if what you say about the dark lodges are true, so there's a dark lodge and it has taken control and they are creating their architecture of control, and they did that thousands of years ago and they merely maintain the architecture now. They, if if that be true, they would be able to, through their seats of power, be able to subtly manipulate myths, legends, and certainly have a hand in writing the so-called holy books. Right? So why would you rely on those as reference to postulate a supposed new truth or a different angle? You're going back to possibly contaminated sources to back up a anti-version of history.
But I don't rely on them for a start. And two, the minds that created those books, they were definitely manipulative. They were conniving.
Mm-hmm.
But the content that they put into the books is often from very pure sources. So that's why you have to go, like a detective, very forensically through it and pick out the stuff that is just bogus nonsense and, you know, arrange it like a person who's an entomologist will do his butterflies or a stamp collector or a coin collector. You have to be very, very methodical about it. It's not that you're relying on it, but you are using it as a reference work.
Well, how do you discern what's bogus and what's not bogus in, say, let's take the New Testament?
Well, that's easy. That's just research. Just study. You can't know it right away. Mm-hmm. There's no magical thing that you have inside yourself. You know, nobody back then was with a video camera to tell us what really it was. So it's an endless, continual process that's updated. You know, just today I put about 10 new links on my appendices pages just today. Every week, you know, I get at least 10 or 20. It's continually being updated. I'm continually learning more. I'm continually throwing out old stuff. I'm continually, you know, correcting errors. Because every even science book, textbook, comes with errata. It's preposterous to think that one person is going to have all the answers. I'm just a maverick scholar, you know. I don't have a degree. I'm not an expert. I'm constantly learning and growing as this process goes. I'm learning from people that are more intelligent than myself, you know, who email me, or I read voluminously. I'm always reading books, yep. Wide variety of books, reading websites, you know, updating stuff, creating new articles, correcting things that weren't quite right or whatever, you know. So, you know, there's nobody standing over me with a big stick. But at the same time, you know, I want to make my work as perfect as possible. Mm. And, you know, there's always going to be things that you're going to change. This is a moving collage. It's like this thing in front of you is like a chimera. You know, it's like a kaleidoscope. You have to see it from many angles. You've got to walk around it multiple times to find out its hues and its colors and its shapes and its forms. And just like the eye can be deceived, so can the mind. We can be wrong. Or we can be seeing something myopically one year, and then we have greater clarity on it the next. So, of course, there's a great responsibility there, you know, and I always try to update my work and correct things and add new aspects, you see, and branch it out. It's a real task. But it's a journey. We don't have all the answers. And we're also historically in a very young time when it comes to this particular kind of thought patterning. Because before, when we had Orthodox religion and we weren't allowed to think, we weren't allowed to travel away from our villages, there was no way that you could be independent. If you did, you ended up in jail or worse. So we are in a very, very, very recent times. We have the great privilege of having that level of Uranian freedom, a mercurial freedom, to even ask some of these questions and go about getting the answers. And that's training, that's patience, that's time, that's deliberation. You're on the track of a predator. You're on the trail of a criminal. And therefore it is absolutely the same as a hunter. He's got to know the terrain. He's got to sit out in the cold. He's got to learn about his predator. He's got to know that his predator is also watching him. He's got to learn almost to think like a criminal. It's a tremendous journey. It's not for lazy people. It's not for people who have given up their power, you see. It's not for people who just want to be running away from themselves and into all sorts of entertainment. It's not for pedantic people who go, you must get it right first time. You know, where are these guys coming from? You know what I mean? Who are they to wave a big stick over anybody or piss on this knowledge like it's some dog trying to territorialize an area? They don't own knowledge. Nobody owns knowledge. Knowledge is for all mankind, and it's evolving as it percolates down through each individual human consciousness. Each person has the right to have a different angle on a certain thing. That's what makes it a beautiful parliament of voices. As we said, the bane of the world that is coming is the world of consensus and uniformity and conformity. This regimented knowledge, this regimented attitudes. Don't we see that all over the world? Mm. So in this area, which is occult, which is esoteric, which is alternative, we don't want any of that. We want to be able to make mistakes because we realize there is really no such thing as a mistake. There's just a challenge. There's just an obstacle to get over. There's just a way to, you know, another veil falls from your face. Another lie, you know, gets blown.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a wonderful, you asked a meditation. It is the meditation. Because we're not, like we said, in Architects of Control, we're not gaining knowledge. We love knowledge. We love it. We have a relationship with it, like we have with a person. You know, I love my books. I love this subject. I love the people who are also studying this. It's a tremendous journey. It's what, I feel I've been on this planet to do. So it's my dharma. It's what I'm meant to do. I don't want to be a follower. I don't want to listen to lies. I want to find out what's going on. But you are walking in the dark. You are walking in an area where you can easily trip and fall and really, you know, hurt yourself. But you see, ultimately, that's the road that I want to go on. That's the road I want to follow. And the pitfalls, I will take it, because otherwise I wouldn't be on that road. If I wasn't able to take the flak, you know, I would have given up years ago. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, and as I say, I give the perfect right to any detractor or any other, you know, party. You know, they want to come and do something about what I'm doing. They have the freedom to do that. I'm not taking it away from them. I do what I do. They can do what they do. It's as simple as that. I'm not frightened by those people. And I'm not really any real major threat to them, as a matter of fact. Because they also have the choice to change their ways if they want. But I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And there's not a force on earth, nor in the sky, that will change it. This is what I'm doing. Nothing on this earth can ever change it. All the sacrifices have already been made. You know, the pain has already been gone through. All the resistances I've had to put up with in 40 years. You know, I've already done it. So, you know, by the time that another child is 15 years of old, I'll be dead anyway. So, you know, I've already lived the majority of my life, and this is what I want to be doing. I just wish I could have actually been doing it a lot earlier without all the resistances and the bullshit, you know, that I had to put up with.
Mm.
But now that is somewhat removed, you know, I get on with the game that I want to be doing, just like anybody else who's passionate about what they're doing, playing the cello, playing the violin, you know, working with computers, whatever. You have to do it for the love of it, the passion of it, not because it's a drudgery.
Yeah. I hear that. Michael, I would really, really, really love to just talk for some more time. We've been at it now for about an hour and a half. If anybody wants to visit your site, they can go to...
Well, they can go to architectsofcontrol.com.
Okay.
Or they can just go to my site, michaeltesarian.com. I have about 9 or 10 sites, and they all are reachable through the Michael Tesarian website. There's also the forum, you know, where we put up a lot of links and stuff like that and current event stuff going
just
on there.
We'll do this again.
You know, we'll definitely, I think your questions, by the way, are absolutely excellent. That's kind of a novelty, you know, because I do so many talks. So it's always great when the host knows what he's doing and has really, really good questions. And that is actually bothered to read or look at your stuff is also something. So believe me, you know, Gabriel, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And I'd love to do it again, you know, in a couple of weeks or whatever.
Well, thank you. I would like to take all the credit, but the other guys did all the work. and you can also, if you go to the Irish side of the moon.blogspot.com, go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You can get Michael, link for Michael's site right there. So if they go to the Michael Tesarian site, they can then go to all your other sites from there. Yes.
Absolutely, and we'll keep you updated on, you know, how the progress is going in these other projects.
Please do.
People can go to the Blogspot there, your website, and hear this interview, right?
Yes, and it'll be going up now in about half an hour.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So, Michael, any last words?
No, just say thank you to you. It's great to hear that you know, from Donegal. It's actually my favorite county in Ireland, and I love it so much. I adore Donegal, and I always miss it when I'm away. And we're hoping if we get the chance to even come out there and film. So if we actually arrive in Donegal, you know, we'll be on your doorstep as well. You're come down, you know, we should get together and have a pint or whatever, you know.
Just give me a week so I can be on vacation that time. Okay.
That's all right. It'd be lovely to see you and chat.
Do. I'll be on the forum, so you'll probably see me popping up on your forum from time to time.
Well, that's great, because by the time we meet, I'm updating the Irish Origins book, so we'll have a perfectly updated copy in a couple of months. So that'll be, you know, give you a presentation of that. I'm sure you'll love it.
Yes. Michael, thank you very, very much for sharing your precious time with us. I hope people got something, and at least they get curious about what they're doing on this planet.
Michael. Absolutely. Thanks for the time, Gabriel. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Take care, Michael. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, certainly that was food for thought. That was Mr. Michael Tesarian. I want to shout out to the video chat. I want to just thanks for listening, guys, discussing. Dave von Kleist 9/11 from last week. Lots of emotion for and against. Any other comments you have or any questions you have about previous shows or tonight's show, just drop me an email at gabriel@theirishsideofthemoon.ie, and you can get previous shows to listen to at the Irish Side of the Moon blogspot.com. Anyway, that is it from me. Lots to think about. Michael certainly brought up lots of points. If you have any questions or any comments that might add to Michael's work, you can directly send him an email or send them in to me, and I'll contact him. Looking forward to chatting to Michael again. Thank you for listening. Stay real. Stay centered. And we will hear more very soon. Thank you.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world is being watched closely by intelligences greater than man, minds that are to
we shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up.
Some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say why not.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Malicious lies and attempts to
just tuned into the Irish Side of the Moon.